Let's call this meeting to order on February 9th. The Jobs and Economic Development Finance Committee. Let's call this meeting to order. We're going to start out with House File 1968. Representative Loon. Is she here?
Not here,
sure. I don't see if she was here.
Let's vote on it.
What?
Let's vote on it. She's not here.
All in favor, signify.
Vote on it.
Yeah. Okay. Since Representative Loon isn't here and went to another committee, let's start out with House File 1823, Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McLaurin.
I'd like to move the minutes of the January 31st meeting.
Okay. I assume everybody's read the minutes. All in favor of that move, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Representative Downey, welcome to our committee. Can't wait to hear about angels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 1823, if there's somebody who could perhaps move the bill for me, Mr. Chair. I didn't arrange that in advance. I apologize.
Okay. I will so move, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Lemire moves House File 1823 to go to taxes. Is that correct?
Correct. Thank you.
Okay. Yep.
A couple of introductory comments, and then if I could, I'd like to ask Jeff Nelson from Deed to come down on the angel investment portion of this, and he can give you an update on the program experience to date. But the bill that you have before you is actually intended to be two-purposed. One is to advance the angel investment tax credit program that we passed into law a year and a half ago now, and to refine some of the provisions of eligibility, and ideally actually to increase the amount of the credit available in the next biennium. And then the second part of it is to introduce a similar program called the Small Business Investment Act, which many of you have heard over the past couple of years referred to as the CAPCO bill. And Representative Winkler carried that, I think, in my first term, and there's been a number of committee hearings on the essential concept of the Small Business Investment Act. But what I thought I'd do just to introduce things is to say, you know, first and foremost, why credits? Why early stage startup investment credits? I guess all of us would like to make some progress on the corporate income tax and pass through income tax rates. But short of that, what we've done in Minnesota and in a lot of other states too is to provide targeted tax credit incentives so that the small startup businesses that we have in Minnesota have the financial kind of level playing field that they do in other states as well. And so this mechanism of providing a very targeted tax credit to early stage companies is what we're pursuing here. A couple of differences between the Angel program and the Small Business Investment Act program that I'd proposed in this bill. Angel tax credit is for very, very, very early stage startups, typically micro businesses, oftentimes still operating in the home, typically funded by a very small number of highly personally related investors, not quite ready yet to go out into the venture capital market or the institutional markets and find funding. So that target, that tax credit for the Angel bill is a very specific target on those smallest of companies. And it's a credit to the investment or to the income of the investors who actually are investing in that company. The Minnesota business investment companies that we're proposing in the second part of this bill would be focused still on small companies, but all the way up to 100 employees. Often still before the time when they could appeal to venture capital, especially now as the venture capital firms have kind of retreated and are really looking for sure things as compared to managing a higher risk portfolio. So this would incentivize investment to the small business world, and it would do so not through just a straight up credit to the investors, but by incentivizing insurance companies to allocate a portion of their reserves in their investment strategy to small businesses in Minnesota. And so the nature of the credit is through a premium tax credit for those insurance companies. The investment mechanism is not directly from the insurance company into small businesses, but to allow them to put their money into small business investment companies in Minnesota who would then do the investing. So basically we're taking advantage of existing angel and venture capital networks and groups that form to make investments in a portfolio of small companies and allowing them to recruit funds from the insurance company investors who typically will have a pretty conservative portfolio and might not be as interested in investing in small business like this absent the credit. So that's the major differences. And what I thought I would do, Mr. Chair, if it's all right, as compared to walking through the bill and dealing with the particulars, if you're all right, and we could have Mr. Nelson come down and present the report on the progress of the Angel program, and then I can walk you through the specific update provisions in my bill on the Angel program, and we can take questions on that, and then we could move to the Small Business Investment Act after that.
Very well.
Thank you.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff Nelson. I coordinate the Angel Tax Credit Program for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I'm going to do just a brief recap of what the program is, and then I'll go into some of the numbers. Basically, what the Angel Tax Credit Program is, it provides a 25% tax credit for investors who put their money into new, small, emerging, high-tech businesses in Minnesota. It covers both high-tech businesses and other types of businesses using some sort of new proprietary technology. The purpose, of course, is to foster the growth of these new high-tech businesses and ultimately create new jobs. Who benefits? Businesses, the investors, and hopefully people looking for jobs within Minnesota. So again, it provides a 25% tax credit for qualified investors who put their money into these new businesses. A key feature of the program is that it's a refundable credit, meaning that if you have no Minnesota state tax liability, you still get a refund for the amount of your credit. In essence, what that means is we are bringing in investors from outside of Minnesota, outside of even the United States, putting capital into our businesses. We do have a few limits on the program. There's a maximum of $125,000 in credits per individual per year. That's $250,000 if married filing jointly. So that means a married couple could put up to $1 million into a new high-tech businesses and get credit for that investment. There are also limits on how much in credits per year that we can grant. This year it's $12 million. I'll talk about that in a few moments. Types of investors that we allow into the program. First of all, an investor must be a natural person. What does that mean? It's someone that can bleed. You pinch them and they bleed. It's a person. An angel investor not only provides money to these companies, but they provide advice and counsel to these companies. They're usually entrepreneurs themselves, successful businessmen, and they are providing a lot of guidance for these new businesses that need to get going. We also allow funds to make investments. Funds must be made up of at least three natural persons. So again, there are real people behind the investment. In terms of the businesses that qualify for the program, number one, of course, they need to be headquartered in Minnesota. Over half of their employees and half of their payroll must be in Minnesota. They must be small and emerging, meaning they have less than 25 employees and they've been in operation for less than 10 years. Also, they cannot have raised more than $4 million in equity investment already. We have three different types of businesses that qualify under the program. And it's a lot of, you'll see when as I walk through this, it's very technology oriented. The reason that you, the legislature, chose that type of business is that it was determined that this is a growth industry and it's high paying jobs. So the first type of business is using proprietary technology to add value to a product, process, or service in a qualified high-tech field, or researching or developing a proprietary product, process or service in a high-tech field, or researching and developing new proprietary technology in some very specific industries, such as agriculture, tourism, forestry, mining, manufacturing, or transportation. So that's a quick background of what the program is. Let me tell you our successes so far. The program started in 2010. It was enacted into law at the very beginning of April, and we began implementation in July. So in 2010, we had half a year. Last year, of course, we had a full year of the program. In 2010, we had 67 companies that were invested in. Last year, 2011, we had 113, so we just about doubled it. Investors, in 2010, 258 investors invested in companies in Minnesota under the program. Last year, 561. In terms of investment angel funds, in 2010, 4 invested in Minnesota companies. Last year, 21. I think these are big increases. More importantly, how much money was put into Minnesota businesses? In 2010, via the program, the investors invested $28 million into these small high-tech businesses. Last year, $64 million. A little over two-thirds of the money is coming from Minnesotans, a little less than one-third from non-Minnesotans. So it is an important component. Last year, in 2010, the average investment was just under $100,000. There are a number of types of companies that are receiving the money. The most common industry types are medical devices, software, biotech, and clean tech. In the first year of the program, one of our disappointments was that we had much more investment in the metro area than in greater Minnesota. We only had about 6 companies that were invested in greater Minnesota in 2010. Last year, 2011, we just about doubled that. But more importantly, the amount of money that was put into the greater Minnesota companies was almost 4 times as much as the previous year. So I think we're making strides trying to make it more equitable across the whole state. And if there's any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Anybody have any questions? Representative Murray.
Thank you, Chairman. This is for the testifier. I appreciate your last comment, and that's what I was kind of wanting to talk about a little bit further was, I think this is a great program, but there seemed to be a little bit of an imbalance with what's happening in greater Minnesota, and I'm just wondering, what ways are you looking at addressing those concerns and trying to help greater Minnesota achieve more with this effort?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative. One of the major things that we started doing last year was trying to basically spread the word to greater Minnesota. I and my director did about 12 different visits to cities in greater Minnesota, doing presentations to various groups, local development officials, et cetera, basically just informing everyone about what the program is and how it can benefit small high-tech businesses throughout the state. In addition, we're working with the Minnesota Angel Network. This is a group that is working very closely with businesses, trying to get them in a position where they can properly present themselves to investors. They have, and we are working directly with them, they are setting up intake centers in 4 different greater Minnesota cities so that businesses can get the help that they need to get into the correct position to be able to work well and gain investment from angel investors.
Representative Murray.
Mr. Nelson, when do you think that you'll have a good idea that those programs are helping to achieve, you know, what you're trying to do in greater Minnesota then?
Well, I think as you saw, Mr. Chair, Representative, as you saw, we almost doubled the number of companies that received investment from 2010 to 2011. And as I said, 4 times the amount of investment that went into these companies. I'm hoping that trend will continue. We plan to continue our outreach in greater Minnesota.
Just one more, Mr. Chairman. If at some point here in the next 6 months to a year you do not see this working, will there be some adjustments that you may offer to make to the program to help investors look at greater Minnesota opportunities a little more?
I think we would redouble our efforts to try to make everyone aware that this program is working and can work in greater Minnesota.
Okay. I would like to just offer, Mr. Chairman, to work with Representative Downey and just, you know, try to address some of these issues, and maybe we can talk offline and as you go through other committees, work together on some of this.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and Representative Murray, yeah, absolutely. I think this is one of the things that jumped out at all of us when we first saw the report here a few weeks ago in our Small Business Caucus, so glad to address that, whether that's something that we try and write into law that would define that outreach, or maybe try and set some program parameter targets or something. I know I'm willing to have that discussion, and I'm glad to work with you and the department on that.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Downey, in your bill on page 12 and 13, on 12 at line 22, you delete all the references to an intern. And then on line 13, page 13, line 34, you delete the requirement for an employer to pay 175% of the federal poverty guidelines for a family of four, which essentially is $18. We went over this particular issue last year and made some significant changes. Is there a reason that you're going to eliminate the idea that an intern should be paid or that these should be high-paying jobs?
Representative Downey.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Mahoney, a couple things. For members, I didn't get a chance to walk through the sections of the bill. The two provisions, one relating to changes to the ANGEL credit, and also the major portion of the bill related to the new Small Business Investment Act, are lumped together, and the sections of statute are overlapping. So sorry, it's a little clunky, but if you go to section 2 of the bill, section 2, 3, 4, and 5, that's starting on page 11, are all the sections related to the tweaks to the ANGEL Investment Act. And what Representative Mahoney is referring to is the elimination of the provision on line 12.22 and then down on page 13.34. The feedback that I've gotten from a couple of different ANGEL fund folks is that the requirement to pay a percentage above the minimum wage is, while on the surface would seem like an important thing to make sure that we are in fact creating high-tech jobs and that these are not just high-tech companies in name, but they're actually able to support high-wage positions as well. The reality is, for a lot of businesses that are in the garage, where the spouse of the owner is doing the accounting, or some family friend is willing to do something to help the business make a go of it, that's a pretty steep requirement to have everybody on the payroll making that kind of a wage. I have talked about this very provision, and in fact all of the provisions in this bill, with Mr. Nelson, and I think we can come to some agreement here, and Representative Mahoney, you may be pleased by the outcome. I think what we can do as we move forward is think about striking that based on the premise, as I've been educated by Mr. Nelson, that these small businesses can in fact contract for those positions and pay whatever they want, so long as they are not in-house employees of that company. And so I think the concern of the folks that I've heard in the venture community can probably be allayed by making that kind of a change, or I don't know if we need to make a statutory assurance, but I think we can probably accommodate your interest to maybe even strike that update to the program, and I'd be comfortable, and hopefully they would be too.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Downey, because that was really one of the I managed to, good, bad, or indifferent, sit in on a lot of the negotiations on this, and that was a pretty big sticking point on someone coming out of college or graduate school or with their doctorate getting stuck with a free internship. And this is really we're trying to create good-paying jobs, whether it's in greater Minnesota or in the metro area. So I certainly hope that whole provision comes out, as I don't think the department found those same issues that angel investors were saying that this was a particular problem for them. I'm not sure if it's, I know that in the earlier discussions about the bill, you had some concerns about the mandatory convertible debt, and I believe it's in the bill here. I don't remember the page right offhand. Could you explain what you're trying to do with that and why, and then I'll kind of respond.
Representative Downing.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's actually a handful of provisions in here that get at the eligibility criteria for the credit. And one thing to remember is that these credits have been oversubscribed. I'm not sure if that's the right term, but there's been more demand than availability of the credit. We have fully subscribed these. And so the question is, could you, without actually inhibiting use of the credit, change some of the eligibility criteria to make sure that we are actually attracting investors who are taking an investment interest, an actual equity interest in these businesses, and therefore in it for the long haul, as compared to simply taking a debt interest in the company, which would simply have you as kind of a payee on notes. And so the changes that you're looking at are intended to move in that direction. There also was some activity that indicated that some companies were simply reconstituting themselves, even though the current instance of the business might not have fit the profile of an eligible business for the credit. And so through a new ownership structure and sale and things, they reconfigure the ownership structure so that it does fit. And so we're trying to avoid some of those things. And I'm glad to have Mr. Nelson offer his opinion on these things as well. I had a list, after working with some venture folks, of about six things, and I know the department agrees with maybe half of those and disagrees on the other half. Again, I think there's a way for us to work this out, so I'm glad to hear his opinion on, or have him offer his opinion on these things too.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney. Representative Downey and I have had a number of conversations about this. There are a number of provisions in Representative Downey's bill that the department agrees with. There are a few loopholes in this bill that we would like to close. I'll give you one example. When an investor purchases an investment in one of our companies, that investor must hold the investment for 3 years. We want continuing investment, continuing involvement in the company. There is, however, an exception, and the exception is that if the company goes public, then the investor may sell his investment. However, there is no place in the bill that prohibits a publicly traded company from becoming certified. So we did run into the instance where, in one case, we had an investor who bought into a company that was already public, and because of the exception, was allowed to, therefore, immediately sell their investment and still claim the credit. Some of the provisions in Representative Downey's bill close that loophole, and we agree with those. One provision we do not agree with, however, is the elimination of a qualified investment being a debt with mandatory conversion to equity. This method of investing is used in a very large degree by individual investors. What it does is, under the provision, the investor buys a debt instrument in the company, but it does, in fact, turn into equity. In fact, to qualify under the program, it must convert to equity within 3 years, if not earlier. So these investors, in fact, are buying an investment, an equity investment within the business, with the added bonus, from their perspective, is in the first few years or months, as it often is, they also gain some interest.
Mr. Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nelson, do you happen to have the number of individual investors, those that would be eligible to do convertible debt, so they would be able to have a small income stream from this, versus funds? So, and the reason I'm asking the question is, are we changing the nature of this particular program to fit a couple of funds? Or are the majority of people that are investing individuals that this might be a good option for them?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I don't have exact figures. I can, just from working with the program, I can say that from one-third to one-half of individual investors are investing in these companies via the debt with mandatory conversion to equity. No funds use that method of making investment in a business.
So, Representative Downey, essentially, you're you're tightening up the rules for individuals and opening up it for institutions. That's not your nature. Having served with you for the last few, you're an individual kind of guy. You like individuals being invested and involved. So I certainly hope that I don't want to get, and you can respond, I don't want to get into a deep, long discussion about it because this thing took days and months to negotiate. But I think you're wrong on this particular point. I really do. I think it serves the interest of a couple funds versus the interest of, I think it was 100, how many individuals, 500 individuals. And I certainly hope you take a look at it because I know this bill is going to taxes and it's got to go to the floor. And if the department doesn't particularly agree with it, I would hope you do that.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney. We did have a discussion, Mr. Nelson and I, in my office, and actually I think we can probably pretty easily come to agreement on the set of provisions. And there's actually one more that isn't currently in the bill that I would like to include that I think they're okay with, and that would allow for those companies who are going through very lengthy FDA approvals under the new FDA compliance guidelines, and then we might extend the term of eligibility for companies that are having to just go through a really extensive FDA approval process and might exceed the life of the company type terms here as well. So there's excuse me, a handful of things that I think Mr. Nelson and I in the department can come to agreement on, and I'm willing to work on all that.
One other thing, and I think I've given you some food for thought here, but it's on the FDA extension. Because this sunsets in 2014, and I can't remember which legislator from Edina suggested that it have a sunset, but I'll go back and look at my records. how will this affect, how will that FDA process be affecting these companies? Will they still be eligible by the time, will there still be the program, do you believe, by the time they get their authorization from the FDA? Because frankly, I agree on this, most everybody I know agrees on the FDA takes really way too long to get through the process on this, and it can take anywhere from 6 to 12 years, which is crazy.
Mr. Chairman, I might defer to Mr. Nelson on that. We talked about it, and maybe he could describe how he might see it actually working within all the eligibility and other criteria they have for their process.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, one of the criteria in the existing legislation is that a business cannot have been in operation for more than 10 years in order to participate in the program. Representative Downey is proposing that we extend that, and I don't believe you have it in your bill.
No, correct.
That we extend that so that the business could have been in operation for less than 20 years if they're a business that needs to require FDA approval. So basically, we're not looking forward, we're looking backwards in terms of when did they begin their operations, and has it taken them a long time to get going and finally get their FDA approval, and now they're ready to raise more money.
And Mr. Chair, I apologize. I did want to highlight one other thing in the bill that I think is a good idea. One of the problems that I'd heard from many of the investors and the companies was that they weren't able to get some of the basic information on a company off the website because of our data privacy laws and your policies over at Deed, which we all set. We set your policies, so it's not your fault. And what is in the bill here allows for more information to go out to investors, and the more investors we get tied into this, the better off we will be. So I want to compliment you for putting that in there and make everyone aware of it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of questions. I agree with the amount of the wages, since that's being removed, and it seems quite harmless when you talk about a family member that assists, and I understand how that works, owning a family business, but I'm wondering if there's, as you work through this, if there can be a tracking mechanism to find out that, in fact, those kinds of systems are working and maybe we're not just going toward like a $10 an hour job for everybody involved. That's a real concern of mine, that since this is tax dollars that we're using for this credit. And I've been a part of the Small Business Caucus, so I agree, and I'm just happy to see the numbers going the right way for the Angel Investor Tax Credit. So I applaud that. But I am kind of concerned with the increase from the $12 million a year to $20 million a year in 2015. Are there measurements that we can use to see if it, in fact, is bringing in more revenue to the state versus being an expense? Is it going to be revenue neutral, and how do we track that?
Representative Donnelly.
Mr. Chair, I might defer to Mr. Nelson in terms of what DEED's further reporting intent is. The stage of the program right now, all we can really track is the number of companies and the size of the investment and the other ancillary investment that it could be seen to have also helped attract to the state. Going forward, we'll have much more empirical data on the companies and their size and their growth and how many went out of business and those kinds of things. But I don't want to speak for the department in terms of their future reporting, you know, intent.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do an annual report on the program. Our first report was last year for the year 2010. Again, that was just a half year of a program, 6 months. And one of the things we reported on was job creation. As one of the testifiers before this committee said last year, when an investment is made in our company, we don't turn around and take that $100,000 and go out and hire someone. We're too small to do that. Usually what we do is we contract that work out, whatever we need done. We go to the firm down the street and say, do this, and that firm probably hires someone. So we are somewhat disappointed in our job creation numbers last year. I believe the report said the program created 47 jobs. There you go. $7 million, 47 jobs. Well, I think we need to step back and wait a while. 3M didn't become a company of 100,000 people, you know, in 1 year. We will, however, continue that reporting. Our reporting is, again, just directly on the number of employees by the company itself, not by any spending that they do of their investment, that then other businesses are hiring people to do that work. Another factor regarding the annual reporting, when this program was first set up, it was set up such that in year 2013, $100,000 has been set aside to do a very comprehensive study on the entire program and its cost-benefit ratio. So by the end of 2013, before the program sunsets in 2014, we should know the payback on this program.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had some questions that I think have maybe been partially addressed. I'm concerned about this striking of the annual wages of at least 175% on the basis that somehow family members would be involved. If we want to make an exception for family members, why don't we be clear about that and not have this be a wage? What I thought I heard you say is, the way Mr. Nelson and others would be satisfied is we'll just call them consultants and hire other people as consultants rather than as employees. And we've been down that road. Saying that consultants cannot be a cover-up for, you know, having employees. So I guess I'd like to suggest that if there should be an exception for family members, we'd be really clear about it, you know, that that works, but that it not become a broad thing. Just tracking stuff after it's done is going to be difficult. I think we should do this ahead of time. And I'd like to ask the department, I guess, yeah, if I figured it right, you said $7 million for 47 jobs. I think it's $150,000 a job about. Is that right?
Mr. Nelson.
Yes.
Okay, just keep that in mind, folks. So I guess what I'm concerned about is, in your bill, Mr. Downey, are we even tracking the number of jobs, and are we tracking the wages? Are you eliminating that up front, too?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair. President Clark, let me back up for a moment and say that in terms of the requirement, the minimum wage requirement, first of all, the program is already set up. It does not apply to company officers, directors, board members, or 20% or greater shareholders. As probably many of you know, these small emerging businesses often have no employees. If they do have employees, it is often the president, the treasurer, the CEO, and the wife, as you know, is probably the CEO. The husband can be the treasurer, such a, in that case. So in reality, I think we've already taken care of that just by the way the program is set up currently.
So, Mr. Chairman? So if we've already taken care of it, why do we need to do what's online on page 13, lines 1334? Do we need to do that? Does the department support or oppose that?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, the department does not support changing the minimum wage requirements either for employees or for interns.
Okay.
The intent, I believe, of the legislature when they first created this program, again, as I said in my opening remarks, was to create high-paying jobs. And I would want to point out that, as Representative Downey has said, we all the credits were subscribed to last year. So all the money that was invested is going into businesses that do meet these high wage requirements.
Mr. Chairman,
just
two more questions. So, I mean, we're talking about interns here, and I think Representative Mahoney said $15 an hour. Is that right? 1-5.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I think an intern's pay, and I'm doing it off the top of my head from last year, it's the minimum is $13.75. The 175% of the federal poverty wage, I believe, is just a bit over $18.
Okay. So I guess we should just all keep that in mind, what we're talking about, federal poverty level, not even apparently getting up to that. So another question I have is, I don't understand tax law as well as some others probably who deal with tax law all the time, but there's words here that I find very convoluted, and maybe I can find them. Before I do that, as I do that, one of the questions I had for the author is, why is it that we're working with insurance companies rather than maybe other possible funders? It seems to me, I don't think they're hurting for dollars. Our insurance companies are doing pretty well in this country, but what is the reason that that's a singular source of funding rather than several sources of funding?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I can't remember, Representative Clark, if you were here, but I did mention that there's two major components to this bill, and the section that we're on now, or actually the sections, are related to the previous angel investment tax credit, and that does not involve the insurance companies. We'll have plenty of discussion on the next part, which is the Small Business Investment Act, which is focused exclusively at insurance companies investing their reserves. So the stuff we're talking about now is the angel bill, which doesn't deal with that, and maybe we can get into that question on the next part of the bill when we go there.
Mr. Chairman, who's the author of the next part of the bill? Is that our chairman, or is that somebody else?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, that would be me. If you'd like to jump from the angel portion to the other, I can call down the testifiers and we can explain that whole section, but I thought it might make more sense to just clean up the discussion on the angel bill first. But I'll defer to the chair on that.
I think that we should probably endeavor to hurry. If the author says we're going to cover that later, I think that's fine with me. Is that all right with you?
Yes, that's fine.
Thank you. Seeing no one else has any questions, Representative Downey.
No, Mr. Chair, I just thought I would, if we're done with that section, close with a couple things. One, the increase in the dollars was referenced as well, and I put that in there, and in good legislative fashion, I put that in there for the next biennium, hoping that we could actually find a way to increase the program, assuming that it's still being subscribed at the level that we've seen it. Who knows whether that's a reality. The bill's going to go to tax committee next, and we'll deal with that at that point. And the overall question about the program working and the jobs, I look at this a little bit more with the private sector viewpoint, and I think if you had about a $50 or $60 million angel fund and you had literally five dozen, maybe even close to 100 firms in that, and they met these kind of criteria, and they were also attracting other outside capital, even from out of state, I think you'd probably say you have a pretty healthy angel portfolio in the mix. And so while it's really difficult to count the jobs today, angel investment funds and angel investment is usually less about jobs and more about creation. And in the old days, you would have seen angel funds trying to turn their investments literally in like 3 years when the early stage market was super hot 10 years ago. The reality is it's probably more like 5, even 10 years now. 5 would be an early turnaround for an angel fund. So I think from what I can tell from the deed reports, this is pretty healthy and looks pretty good. How it translates into jobs and how many of those 60 to 100 companies actually really flourish and how many die off, I mean, we'll watch that and be able to test the program. And so I have the $20 million increase in there, or the increase to $20 million in the next biennium, on the hopes that we'll see really good results, and that might be compelling enough for the legislature to stick with that in the next biennium.
So we're really talking about an $8 million increase?
Yes, Mr.
Correct?
Chair.
Okay. All right. I think that should take care of this part.
Yep. Thank you.
Part number two.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, just again, this is the second part of this bill, and they're all lumped into one as part of an overall kind of early stage small business and incentive package for the tax committee. And if I could, I would just have Mr. Cassidy maybe outline the program. You've heard it in here before, and Representative Mullery and others had some questions, and I'm hopeful that Mr. Cassidy's presentation will address a lot of that and show you some of the refinements that have come since the programs in question were actually in place in other states.
Mr. Cassidy, welcome to our committee. Say your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cassidy with Leonard Street and Dinard. I believe Representative Downey has covered most of the aspects of the program, but I just wanted to highlight a few things. First and foremost, these are companies that are the next stage after investments like an angel tax credit or an angel investment. The companies that we're talking about in this bill have to be Minnesota-based companies. They have to have less than 100 employees. The typical investment is $300,000 to $3 million, and they are typically companies that have become unbankable. By that I mean, number one, they have gone to their banker and they just don't meet the pro forma of the bank, but they are companies that are on the verge of growth, but they just are simply unbankable. The next step for those companies is basically that they either sell the company or sell their product. They fail, or else they move out of state to someplace where they can get financing. So this program is custom designed for that, to get to those companies as quickly as possible and to keep them here. The other feature of the program is that it uses investment managers, professional investment managers, to manage the companies and to place the investments and to go out and find those companies in the state of Minnesota that actually need this capital. And as we all know, by looking at the paper each morning, the headlines in the business section, there's pent-up demand for capital. The banks aren't lending, and even though we're slowly coming out of a recession, those companies are desperately in need of capital, and they need it now. Investment managers and investment professionals know where those companies are, and they will go out and place those investments and work with them on a daily basis to make sure that they succeed. The other aspect of this program I want to point out is its sustainability. It is a program that has existed for over 10 years. It's been adopted in 12 states. It has been reauthorized 34 times in those 12 states. A couple of other states are looking at it during this legislative session as well, including the state of Wisconsin expanding their original program. With that, if I could take just a couple of moments to walk through the bill, a couple of highlights in the bill so that everyone understands a couple of things. First of all, the qualified businesses that can get a credit, as I mentioned before, have to be based in Minnesota, not partially based, but based in Minnesota. They have to have less than 100 employees. Number two is the certification of the investment managers. The investment managers have to have the experienced investment professionals, investment companies. They have to have more than $500,000 in operating capital, and they have to pay a $7,500 certification fee to deed. Next, the insurance companies, and this is maybe gets to Representative Clark's question. Insurance companies are the basis of this bill in terms of the capital that's available. The reason for that is that insurance companies have reserves, are required to have reserves to pay out their policyholders. Those reserves have to be invested someplace. there's a portion of those reserves that regulators, the Department of Commerce, allows them to invest in programs like this. And I can name off a number of insurers, national insurers, strong insurance companies that participate in this program, continue to, and will into the future as well. No insurance company, though, however, can be more than a 15% investor in this program. The other unique portion of this this bill is that Subdivision 5 and Subdivision 2, and that is how you keep the investment managers, keep them investing, getting money out on the street. There's benchmarks here, most of which that the investment managers have to follow, and within 2 years they have to have 35% of their capital out on the street invested in companies, and by year six they have to have 100%. Our experience is that that occurs much, much more quickly than this schedule would suggest. The reason it does is because of the pent-up demand, and investment managers don't get paid until they have 100% of their capital invested in companies. Next, Mr. Chairman, if I can point out just a couple of other areas would be the reporting that has to be done, first by the investment managers to deed in terms of where they're making their investments. This has to be done on an annual basis because they're recertified by deed every year. Where they're making their investments, how much capital they've put out into the market, what that capital has been invested in, and audited financial statements of their operations. And then finally, on an annual basis, we have to report back to the governor and the legislature regarding all the things I mentioned earlier, where the designated capital is being invested, the amount of the investment credits, location of the jobs and the jobs created, and how many have been sustained. And then finally, one other aspect is that once this program is put into effect, the $100 million, the investment managers go out and they talk to their insurance clients and raise the capital. They create funds, each of them. Let's just say there'd be between three and six of them in the state in this program. They raise the funds from the insurance companies. The insurers do not get paid their tax credits until year four of the program. So you can put $100 million on the street in 2012, and the state doesn't start paying those tax credits back to the insurance companies until 2016. And I believe Representative Downey's bill spreads those tax credits out over 5 years. In fact, it does. I'm just trying to recall that. And in 2016, 10% of the tax credits could be paid out. 2017, 15%, and then 20% of the tax credits in years 18, 19, and 20. Mr. Chairman, with that, I would be willing to stand for questions.
Any questions? Representative Hooley.
I've got a few. We'll be here for a minute.
Don't forget the chairman's bills last.
I'm sorry, but we'll be back.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that.
Mr. Cassidy, or Representative Downey, having done some of my research, and you continue to say that $100 million will be put on the street. This is $100 million of insurance companies' investments. Do you know how much the insurance companies require the Capco companies to securitize their $100 million and what the investment is of the insurance companies? The insurance companies required them to securitize their investment with.
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I believe, first of all, it's on a transaction-by-transaction basis, depending on the insurer. First of all, it's backed by a guarantor, of the investment, okay? An insurance company into the Capco. And the guarantor oftentimes is Berkshire Hathaway, some of the larger insurer investment houses that stand behind the investment. So that's why the insurers are comfortable participating in the program. Second, in terms of how much, and you're talking about how much the program participants, the investment managers, actually put into the game. In terms of investment.
No.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
What I would like to know, most of the insurance companies that have invested in a Capco setup mm-hmm. have required the venture capitalists to buy high security bonds or treasury bonds, which means that of that $100 million, the venture capitalists, the Capco companies, have to take how much of that and put it into a bond fund that is not being invested in Minnesota, is not being invested in small companies. Now, I have the average here. I'm wondering to see what your average is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I don't have that information, but I can certainly get it for you. But I can tell you that the requirement of the program is that all $100 million be invested in Minnesota businesses.
Well, Mr. Chair.
That's what needs to happen at the end of the day.
So this is going to be that unique of a Capco program that no other state, all of these other insurers have required at minimum 55% of whatever you're investing. Wisconsin was 50, Washington, D.C. was 150 million. Florida, before they nixed the program, was $200 million. They wanted somewhere between 55 and 65% of that total dollar figure put into those bonds. So in our case, if they do $65 million, there's really only $35 million to invest in these companies. Am I? Are you tracking where I'm going with this?
I am. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, 100% of the dollars are invested in Minnesota businesses. It has to be. That's the way the bill is written.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
So could a Capco venture capitalist take $35 million, because that's what they're going to have available, and invest in a fairly stable company right off the bat, give them a quick loan for a year or 2 years, or you know, an investment for a year or two, sell it, and take that $10 million. They've invested that $10 million for 2 years. They sell it or pull their money out with their profits, and then invest that $10 million right away and count that as $20 million of their $100 million.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I'm not following on that point, actually.
No.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, in most states that have a Capco system going, you have 65% of the dollars in treasury bonds or some other high secure investment, so that the insurance companies have a sense of security that their investment won't be lost. What these Capco companies do is they go out and they churn that $35 million two or three times to reach, in our case, the $100 million. Representative Downey had earlier spoken to the fact that it's a 5 or 10 year window for an angel. Having talked to a couple of the venture capitalists here in town, the standard is 5 to 7 years for this second stage venture capital. How does the Capco venture capitalists, how are they able to do something that much better than the people that have been doing it for 25 years in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Cassidy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe I can take that. And Representative Mahoney, I'd draw your attention to line 2.2 and 2.4, I think. So this is where we define designated capital, and it pretty clearly states that it's got to be invested in a Minnesota business investment company, or it could be some kind of a financing instrument on ownership equity. And then so that would preclude the proceeds of the money eligible for the credit from being used for bonding and insurance purposes. And I'm not familiar. I'd have to go look at those other states to see what they were doing. But typically, if a venture capital fund is somehow insuring its investments, that would be a separate transaction and administrative cost to the fund as compared to the direct use of the investment proceeds. And I don't know what those other mechanisms are that you're talking about that somehow took the money that was due the credit and used it for those purposes. That is not the intent of this bill, and if we've written it wrong, then we can correct that. But the intent, I think, is that it would all be invested or be used to fund the investments of others. And in Subdivision 5 on page 7, it talks about the requirements for the business investment company, the venture group actually doing the investment, irrespective of churn, and I would fully expect that they probably would churn if they had a sizable fund. They'd probably turn over a lot of those investments pretty quickly, either for quick return purposes or something in the portfolio not going well and they just want to exit and do something more productive with those monies for the remaining period of time. But on 7.10, it says that within 2 years they have to have at least 35% of their overall designated capital in investments, and then 7.13, within 3 years, 50%, and then down below on page 8, line 1, within 4 years, they got to have 60%, and within 6 years, 100%, or they aren't eligible for the credits that start coming then in years 4 and after. So I hope we've got the controls in this bill that address your concerns, and if not, I agree with every one of your points conceptually. And so if we don't have the wording right, I'm glad to go back and clean that up. But that's the intent of the way the program would be managed.
Is that only?
Well, I'm glad you have the intent, but the track record for Capco Investments are exactly as I described them. So I'm amazed that you believe that insurance companies are going to hand over $100 million to XYZ investors without the guarantee that they're going to get their $100 million back plus their tax credit. I'm not insurance company's best friend, but I've never claimed them to be stupid. I don't know why they would do something that much different than every other state does. But if you have that intent, and you can show me where it is in here, because I don't see it at this particular time. And I've had a number of people go over this particular bill, and they all agree with me that you're likely to have a substantially less than the $100 million. But I can go on. I've got other particulars with the Capco investment.
Mr. Chairman, if I can address that point. So I am not familiar with this, with the nature of these other Capco programs wherein an investor, i.e. the insurance company, would choose to take a very small sliver of their overall investment portfolio, which is by and large extremely conservatively managed and invested, and for a small chunk of it to have a higher risk portfolio portion, to say, okay, we're going to take a chunk of our portfolio, invest it somewhere in a higher risk portfolio for a higher return to get a little bit better average return in our overall investment strategy. Why you would then go out and incur the entire cost of treasury notes to somehow guarantee your return, you're almost by definition undermining the value of taking a higher risk portfolio. So I'm not sure where what you described occurred or how that worked. I'm glad to look into it and make sure that our bill does not have 40% of the $100 million investment pool going simply for insurance or bondedness to somehow protect the investments. That is not my experience with venture funds working in this kind of an environment, but I'm glad to look into it.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative Downey, and I do mean to take up a lot of the time here, because I've looked at the Capco, and I'm unfortunately have real problems with half your bill. Could you go over how the state profits? I mean, do we get 2%, 20%? Do we get our $100 million back? Venture capitalists typically work, if I'm a cabillionaire and I go to you as the venture capitalist and I say, here's my $250 million, I want you to go invest it, you typically go and invest my $250 million. You take a 2 or 2.5% management fee, and then the profits are divided up. And you get 20%, and I get 80%. I'm sorry, just the opposite. You get 80%, and I, as the principal investor, get 20%. So I get my money back, I get 20% of the profit, and you get 80% of the profit and a 2% management fee. How does that work with these particulars? Does the state get back its $100 million? Do we get 20% of the profit? Does the Capco people get a 2% management fee?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Mahoney. First of all, I think on page 9, line 9.30, the state does have a 10% participation in net profits. So that's the way the bill's written at 10%. Secondly, the entire concept here is that to grow jobs and to grow revenues, so that the revenues actually pay back the tax credits over time.
Well, wouldn't it just be smarter for us to take $100 million out of the state treasury, hand it to Howard Bickers over at the pension fund, and say, go manage $100 million with the local VCs, be sure that we get our money back, because that's what everybody else does, plus 20% of the profit. And we don't do $100 million in tax breaks to insurance companies, we get jobs, and we get 18% or 10% more profit. Am I missing something here?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, you actually raised a number of interesting questions. It'd be a great debate here. I appreciate that I'm standing between the chairman's bill and the end of the
Yeah, because $100 million could pay for profit.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I think that's an interesting discussion to talk about what the State Board of Investment does relative to its high-risk portfolio. And a number of other states have been far more aggressive in allowing their boards of investment to do just what you described. So I'd compartmentalize that and say that's a separate topic for discussion and a worthy one. Wisconsin, I don't know what their number is now, but I think they were well north of $100 million years ago in their higher risk investment portfolio. So that's a good discussion to have, and one that could work. And then there were some other questions in there about the relationship between the venture capitalist and the state of Minnesota. And a couple of points. First of all, Mr. Cassidy mentioned that we do have a 10% return on investment hook here, and that's kind of an advance from what other states have done previously or in the early iterations of the Capco, which is, I think, where a lot of your criticisms come from, and a lot of them are warranted. But I would mention that this small business investment company structure, while we would take advantage of what you might typically call the venture capital world or the early stage investing world, this is a little bit of a hybrid animal that we're creating here that would be certified with the state. So the small business investment company, while it might actually in its other lines of business and things actually be a venture fund, venture funds typically are far more highly speculative. They tend to be really high home run type opportunities, and while they're not exactly like the angel program that we've put together, they're a little more akin to that, but just on a larger scale. And the intent here is, as Mr. Cassidy said at the very beginning, for those businesses that actually have a bright future, but for whatever reason do not fit the risk profile of traditional lending environments, community banks and other bankers and other investment house arrangements, this is designed to capture that segment of the market in Minnesota. And I know we're talking a lot about early stage investment here in these committees for the last couple of years. We've got a life cycle challenge in Minnesota. Not only have we in the last few years not really attracted the early stage angel type investment that we were years ago, we also don't have as much attractiveness for companies kind of going through, you hear they're called the valley of death and all these other terms, right? It's really tough to get through your initial idea generation, establish a market, and then find investors to take you to the point where you can scale. And then I think we have an even bigger problem long term in Minnesota, and how do you take those companies that are ready to scale and keep them here? Because this is all about investment, right? I mean, this is a collective private sector investment. you're taking brain power, you're taking financial resources, you're taking people's time, relationships, all of those things, and you're incubating all of these businesses. And then guess what happens in Minnesota? When they get to the point when they're going to scale and really generate profits and hire a ton of employees and pay income taxes and corporate income taxes and all that, guess what? They aren't going to hang around in Minnesota. They're going to move across the border. They're going to outsource their manufacturing. So we've got an entire life cycle challenge here, and I think we did a nice job with the Angel Investment Tax Credit to put that very first early stage piece in place so that we're competitive with our neighbors. And now we're trying to do something for that next stage where the traditional institutional markets just aren't able to support these kind of businesses and their potential. And then we got a long-term problem, which is a much more fundamental tax reform issue. So we're not dealing with all of it, but we're going after part of it, and I think we're doing it intelligently.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, I've got two more things, and then I'll be quiet because I know the chair wants to get his bill done. Quickly, can you explain to me why Tennessee gets 50% back and yours only calls for 10%? 50% of the profit versus our 10%. Why are we that much lower on the totem pole than Tennessee?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, every state's program is different. And getting back to your reference to CAPCO each time, every state has improved on this program since the first one was adopted, and different participation rates by state, different tax credits. We'd be one of the states with an 80% tax, or 85, I'm sorry, Representative Downey's bill. Most states have been 100. There's been a couple that are even been lower. But each state has been different. And up for discussion.
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion. If anyone else has got questions, I'd like to make a closing statement to this bill. I'll do it right now. Representative Downey, more than comfortable with the first half of your bill. I think the angel investment stuff that you're working on is a really good idea. But this particular part of the bill is truly a mistake. If you were trying to do, or if you were trying to do, and I know you are, what you just spoke to, the Valley of Death, helping those companies stay here, there's models around the nation, whether it's Oklahoma, and I can't remember the acronym, or Utah with its fund of funds, or Pennsylvania with its fund of funds, where it's literally just, we're going to take money, and the state as a whole are going to be venture capital partners with private companies, private equity, and there's no tax credits. The state doesn't lose out on that revenue source. There are many better ways, and for this reason, I don't know where this bill is going. I suspect the taxes. I'm going to likely vote against it. But I hope at some point you separate the bills so I can vote for the first one.
Representative Downey.
Well, I'm glad to make a closing statement, too, if there aren't any other questions.
Any other questions from the members? Seeing none, make your closing statement.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, ideally, Representative Mahoney, if it were totally up to me, I'd find a way to cut our state spending and eliminate the pass-through income tax on these kind of ventures and eliminate the corporate income tax and really turn our entire state into an investment zone. But we probably can't find a way to do that given the current configuration of the legislature and the governor's office. And so we're left with these kind of activities where we offer some tax credits and try in very specific places to allow the private investment community to have the funds available in spite of our tax levels here to do the good things that they can do out in the market as only they can do. And the alternative is probably much more akin to the governor's jobs program and these other things where the state is somehow going to build its own investment funds. And I would argue that as a slice of our overall State Board of Investments investment policy, there's probably an appropriate spot for them to do more early stage high risk investing, and it will probably be good for the investment long term. But short of that, I just would argue against trying to turn the state and its internal processes into a venture capital firm or an investment house. And so we might just disagree philosophically. I would say the best way is to allow the private sector to hold on to a little bit more of its money and find a way to deploy it effectively in the private markets the way they always do, as compared to bringing it in here and then figuring out how to invest it as a legislature or state agencies. So I really think this bill represents the absolute best. All of the learning that's gone on with the CAPCOs, it's intelligently structured, it's focused in the right market segment, and we should give this a chance and test it out.
Okay. With that, who moved here, Bill?
Lemire.
Representative Lemire renews his motion to have House File 1823 will be sent to taxes. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
Okay, motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. And Representative Loon. We're going to probably have to lay my bill over for next week, and we're going to start my bill after yours, but probably won't get it done.
Carol? I would like to move House File 1968, Representative Loon, and this will be for laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the members of the committee. I am Representative Jennifer Loon. I'm very pleased to present House File 1968, which I am co-authoring, but offering as a prime sponsor, but of a number of co-authors, both bipartisanly supported. This would provide for $12 million from a bonding request for the renovation and expansion of the Minnesota Children's Museum. The museum, which is located in downtown St. Paul, nonetheless has statewide significant impact. They get 400,000 visitors every year from virtually every county within the state of Minnesota. And I know as a mother that used to have two young children, we've spent many, many happy hours at the Minnesota Children's Museum. The project would result in a 50% increase in the gallery and programming areas. Right now they have 7 galleries. They would move to 10, and they would increase their capacity to serve 550,000 children each year, from birth to age 12, and that would be a growth of 30% in their visitorship. And I understand from visiting with them that many times they have people that have to wait in the hallways for entrance to the museums, especially on special times when it's free admission, and waiting to get into some of their more popular galleries. So this expansion would help alleviate some of that problem. The overall project cost of this expansion is $26 million. So the $12 million that we're proposing from the state and bonding would be matched with $10 million in private funding and $4 million in some federal tax credits. And here to answer all of the questions is Diane Kreisen. She is the president of the Minnesota Children's Museum.
Welcome, Ms. Kreisen. If you could identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Absolutely. Thank you. Diane Kreisen. I'm president of Minnesota Children's Museum. I appreciate the opportunity to bring our project to life today. And so you have a handout in front of you, but we also have it on the video screen as well. The first page is an illustration of the expanded museum. On the right side of that illustration is a 4-story addition. So it would be on land that we already own. And then we rearrange the whole building in kind of a full museum makeover, and that's what gains us the 50% increase in public space and then the ability to serve more visitors. First, just a little context about Minnesota Children's Museum. Already today, with the before expanding, we do have the 7th largest attendance of any children's museum in the country. So over the 30 years that we have since opening our doors, we have welcomed more than 8 million visitors to Minnesota Children's Museum. And we have a national reputation just in the last year. Twice have been recognized in a national publication. Parents Magazine recognized us as a top 10 children's museum, and Forbes Magazine just in January named us as a top 12 children's museum in the country. So we're proud of that national reputation we have. And we also have a, we develop exhibits that tour around the country. And so in addition to the 8 million visitors that have come to our space here, we also have reached 13 million children across the state with the exhibits that we create. And as Representative Loon mentioned, we do have statewide reach. Our current audience is 400,000 visitors each year. And the maps show, kind of from left to right, we have visitors that come from all over the state of Minnesota, and in fact have some pretty high penetration in counties that are very distant from the metro area. We also have visitors who come frequently enough that they become members, you know, all the way from the southern tip to the northern border of our state. And in the yellow diagram there, we do have school groups that come to the museum as well from about 50% of the counties in the state. Other ways that we have a statewide impact are also we do professional development for early childhood educators, and we reach, I think that's 75 of the 87 counties last year, reaching nearly 1,600 educators across all those counties. And thanks to legacy funding, we have been able to make a significant expansion in access around the state. We are opening a second children's museum in Rochester, Minnesota, that will be opening up towards the end of March. We are also have an exhibit that we developed called Storyland, which is a literacy-based learning exhibit that brings to life three children's books, and it is traveling around the state. In fact, I was in Redwood Falls on Saturday for that grand opening. Before that, we have been in Worthington and Elk River. After we leave Redwood Falls in June, we head to Chisholm next, and on to Duluth and Detroit Lakes, and we'll soon identify the next cities after that. And so excited to bring that exhibit to increase access to cultural experiences around the state. And in addition to that, we are also working to install literacy exhibits in predominantly libraries around the state, transforming the children's book area of libraries, and creating, again, a permanent installation this time that's based on the six pre-emergent literacy skills that children need to become masters in reading and writing. And we started out by putting those spaces in locations in St. Paul, Eagan, and Hopkins. And now we'll be expanding around the state. We're working on a space in Grand Rapids. We're also working in one in North Minneapolis. And, again, are about to issue a request for proposal to be able to expand that to 12 more locations around the state over the next 2 years. So as far as the expansion of the museum in St. Paul, we are growing once again. So it's kind of a history of our growth. In the 30 years we've been there, we did start in Minneapolis, then moved to Bandana Square, and then 16 years ago moved to our current site, which is really just a stone's throw away from here. We have not expanded in 16 years as our audience size has grown. And, you know, perhaps some of you have visited our space with young children, but certainly when I talk to individuals who have come to our space, they nod when I talk about the crowding that we have. And crowding absolutely limits our attendance, and it compromises the learning experience for the children as well when you have to be standing, waiting, you know, in line to use, you know, to engage in a certain feature of the museum. So as Representative Loon mentioned, the total project is $26 million. We would more than meet the matching requirement with other sources of funds. And these bullet points hardly do justice to the excitement of the project. So I do welcome anybody who would want to come for a tour, because I'd love to be able to bring it to life. But in a nutshell, it is the 50% increase in public space, as was mentioned, so that we could grow to 550,000 visitors. We are planning on growing our visitorship just by 30% to serve more, but also to alleviate the crowding, growing to the 10 galleries, all of it renovated around the latest research in early childhood development, The whole fourth floor will be focused on science, technology, engineering, and math to really foster early development of inquiry and problem-solving skills. We have the a brand-new third floor that would be created that we're calling the Creativity Commons that would provide all sorts of what's called loose part play for children to have access to materials and to use their imagination to create what they will. So, for example, large construction materials, and one set of children might design different ski ramps to race balls. In another area, you know, children might decide to make forts out of those materials, but they would be frequently changing materials you know, for children to kind of creatively problem solve and collaborate with others on that. We also are expanding our early childhood gallery. That is a space that Minnesota Children's Museum was an innovator in this, in creating the first dedicated space for children 0 to 3 years old in a museum, and now that's been copied by museums all over the country, and it is by far our most crowded space. So we'll move that to a different location that it can double in size and provide an even richer breadth of learning experiences for children. And then just one other feature to mention, we also have what we're calling our physical adventure gallery that we're going to put in place, starting on the ground floor. It will have a soaring four-story climber with ramps and tunnels and ladders, just kind of a vertical maze, and surrounded by that with things like boogie boards and stationary bicycles to get kids physically active in that space. So Minnesota Children's Museum is a cultural attraction that improves the quality of life here in Minnesota. It also is an early learning resource for our state. It does kind of double duty on both that cultural and learning front. And also the project does have economic impact. So the expanded museum would involve, we'd need to increase our staff by about 20% in this expanded space. We also would put, with the expanded museum, about $8 million back into the economy through wages and procurement of goods and services. With 550,000 visitors coming to us, there's obviously related spending that happens with that. And as with the construction job, it does create a significant, construction project creates jobs in the construction trades, designers, engineers, and that for that particular project. So I wanted to give an update on the private side of the funding. Minnesota Children's Museum is blessed to have deep relationships and strong private support throughout the history of our organization. I have here just a sampling of some of the executives that are on our board of directors currently. We have raised $1.7 million to date. And we have, you know, many conversations and a lot of interest from many friends looking to support us. Some of those are looking to see what the state does so that they can make sure that the project would stay on the timing that it is on. And that timing is that our plan would be to put shovels in the ground in May of 2013 and have the fully expanded museum back open to the public. We would say open for the majority of that time, but there's going to be about 3 to 4 months that where we, you know, just be too much construction dust, we'll have to close down. But the full museum would be completed by fall of 2014. So with that, I just provide contact information if you have questions in the future. But Mr. Chair would be happy to answer any questions if there are.
Thank you. I have a question for you. I'm looking at the picture. Are you expanding east or south?
Oh, you're testing my geography. We are expanding towards Mickey's Diner. So that towards St. Peter's.
Yeah, that's west.
West. Thank you.
Okay.
You never know. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a little known green space there that people don't realize. They think that we're landlocked there, but we have a fence around the space that isn't being used, isn't occupied with the building, so we don't have to change any streets or sidewalks or anything, okay. And it is space we already own.
And you feel you have ample parking in the area?
We have parking kitty-corner from the space at the Wells Fargo Tower, and there are other parking spots available, but the city has assured us that they will make sure there's plenty of parking available to bring visitors.
That's wonderful. Any questions from the committee? Yeah. Representative Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. St. Paul Chamber and the City of St. Paul, are they totally on board?
So the City of St. Paul has made this a top priority. So it went through the City Council, and they voted on it and made that a top priority. And we've also had conversations with the Chamber as well.
But they haven't committed either way yet?
Yeah, I guess I, you know, maybe my lack of savviness, I haven't asked for a formal commitment from the Chamber. So I take that as sage advice.
Madam Chair,
how
far is this from the farmer's market?
Oh, yeah. That sounds about
so. If right. If this were to survive and be put in the bonding bill, and the Saints ballpark would be in the bonding bill, your attendance probably would go up another 20% because the people could spend a full day there with family in the summertime.
And then they could stop at Candyland.
That was just a little help with your project.
All right. Good positioning. Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
I have a statement.
Representative Chair Gunther.
I was just curious of Representative Paymar and Mahoney being part of the St. Paul delegation are both in favor of this.
Chair, absolutely. I've been to the Children's Museum with our kids many times. It's a great project, and actually Friday we're formalizing our recommendations. I'm sure this is going to be one of the top priorities, along with a minor ballpark over Lower Town.
Good to know that.
I speak to Representative Mahoney.
I wanted to echo my good partner's words.
Thank you.
Even down to my children spent a lot of time there, too.
Great. Well, if there aren't any questions, thank you very much, and this will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the next bill. I will move House File 6, or would you like to move your own bill? Okay. We'll wait till Representative Gunther gets there.
Madam Chair.
Representative House.
Are we probably not going to vote on the chairman's bill today?
Probably not. No.
Okay. So I'm in full support, but I believe I have to go do something real quick so I could vote next week on his wonderful bill?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gunther.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Representative Chairman House. The profit bill, as I call it, is, some people say, a takeoff on Job Z. However, there are many, many significant differences. Number one, there is no area of the state that is exempt from having a profit zone in their district. To say that the metro area has all the prosperity in the world is grossly wrong. We know better than that. There are many areas of the metro area that need help, and this bill will help them. When it was first introduced, it was a bill that really helped Greater Minnesota a lot, even though I argued with then Majority Leader Pawlenty that it should be statewide. No other state that's ever had a tax-exempt zone, Eric Deal, went and exempted any part of their state but us. And there are tax benefits for areas that become profit businesses. And you get a property tax exemption for up to 12 years. It can be, the local government can pick 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, 8 years, 10 years, or a dozen years. And if you have an industry that you really want to come in real bad, and it can employ 1,000 people, at $25 an hour, you might want to give them 12 years, just to make sure you get them instead of Iowa, who has a lot more money, according to Chairman Mahoney, for economic development than Minnesota does. And it's 12 miles from where I live, and I want to beat their socks off. I think this is one way we can do some of that. In the metro area, where 70% of the growth is, there's no prevailing wage problem whatsoever, because prevailing wage basically mirrors the union wage for Minnesota. Job creation requirements. To be eligible for a profit benefit, a business needs to agree to create at least 10 full-time jobs, and they have 2 years to do that, and to pay the incumbent employees If they're from the metro area, it'll be around $35,000 a year. If they're from greater Minnesota, it'll be around $25,000, $27,000. We are refining that. We will have it done before tax committee hearing. So those are things that we got to look at. We're getting good jobs. They aren't going to be competing with each other. They aren't moving across town. We're taking care of those problems. We're trying to take everything about Job Z that we found was not right and make it better. And Ms. Newman's making us really stick to that task. And eligible start date, the profit will be implemented July 1st, 2012. I have an amendment we'll give at our next hearing. Eligible businesses will focus on businesses in those industries that tend to have significant sales outside of Minnesota. Example, regional, national, and industrial markets in such industries as manufacturing, warehousing, distributing, information, example, data centers. That's something we just started last year in Minnesota, I believe, and I think it's going to bear a lot of fruit. Finance and insurance and professional and technical services and company headquarters. Retail local services provide stadiums and gambling, etc., are not eligible to become a qualified profit business. The business can contact a local economic developer. St. Paul Port Authority, Louis Jamboy, his father died, and we all wish him well, and he was going to try to testify next time he comes, because I don't think there's anybody in the state of Minnesota that knew more about Job Z and how it worked and how this concept works than Louis. And we'll look forward to having him come here too. Local governments will be responsible for the initial approval of profit applicants. Local approved firms are forwarded to Deed for final approval. Deed will consider all factors in its review, including the but-for test, harm to competitors, and the cost-benefit analysis, and the business subsidy agreement will be signed by Deed and the local government and the businesses. So those are the way. That's the way it. We intend for this to work. Like I say, between now and tax time, we have a couple improvements already that our revisor's office didn't quite get done. They were only given about 2 hours. So with that, I would certainly like to try to answer any preliminary questions.
Would you first like to move the bill?
I would love to. I thought you did.
I thought I'd give that honor to you.
Madam Chairman, I move House File 1676 to be approved and sent to Tax Committee.
Great. Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Pemer.
Representative Gunther, thank you, Madam Chair. So where is there a fiscal note, or is there a fiscal note?
That's something
drawn
we're waiting for. Also, I know the cost will be delayed 2 years because the way that they set the thing up. And I really believe that we can build a fairly decent case that the thing doesn't cost, it pays. Representative Paymar, I think, I know it's incredible, isn't it?
Doesn't cost the state.
This is a performance-based program now. It's a little different than Job-Z. We will have a fiscal note. Okay.
Sure. Representative Gunther, there was a preliminary fiscal note that was distributed today.
Mr. Soderberg, would you like to go through that?
Mr. Chairman, this is just the cost of administrating the program. Obviously, the revenue estimate will come when they go to taxes. And you can see, if you look at the preliminary, that
thank you.
The cost in the first year, or fiscal year 12, as they set it up and then move forward through the next three fiscal years, is $90,000. That cost is all Department of Revenue figures throughout the four-year period showing. Deed does show a cost, but they think that they are indicating that they would be able to absorb that cost. I think if you look on page 7 of the preliminary, you'll see the Deed portion, which is our agency. They think it'll be about $70,000, but they feel they can absorb that throughout the years that they would have costs. So, like I said, this is just the administrative portion of the bill. Obviously, as it goes to taxes, they will be doing a revenue estimate. We'll look at the amount of cost of the general fund for the tax and portions of the bill.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Paymar.
Well, I'll wait till tax committee then to just ask those questions perhaps I've gone through, but I guess I'm still trying to figure out, you know, I understand you've tried to clean up some of the problems from Job Z, but it still seems like Job Z to me, except it's not, I mean, the Metro, obviously, businesses in the Metro could now qualify, but it's still exempting sales tax, property taxes, requiring then a shift in those areas where that business presumably would locate. And what then, one of the big philosophical problems with Job Z was, is like, what would prohibit a business from moving from one area to another area to take, to get the benefits from, what is this program called? From profit. I mean, aren't we still setting up an unfair competitive disadvantage by offering these kinds of incentives the same way we did with Job Z?
Chair Gunther.
Madam Chairman, in the respect of one person moving from one side of town to another, you have a requirement of $500,000 building requirement plus 10 full-time job requirements. That means if an existing building has 40 people working there, they then would have to have 50. And at the end of the period of time that the local government decided this benefit would go to them, which could be 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 years, it can vary according to what the local government's wishes are. It's one thing that's hugely different about the mandatory 10 years that Job Z had. Mm-hmm. And it can go in existing buildings. It doesn't have to be brand new building. A $500,000 existing building remodel could qualify also. So in Representative Clark's district and your district, there are significant numbers of those types of buildings there that could use a new tenant. And I think when you look at the total goal of this thing is to get people employed and to get workers from the construction industry busy. I think this has got a lot of merit. I think you have to just read the literature that came from the western border of Wisconsin to see how awesome they thought this program was when it first started. And we're putting it in the metro area. I think they're going to start stuttering over there. I really do.
More than they already do?
More than they do. Yeah, sure.
Mr. Chair,
Representative.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Are we going to discuss this more at the next meeting?
At the next meeting.
Okay,
yeah.
I'll just hold off. Tell me.
Okay.
Thank you. I like your questions.
Representative Leidiger. Oh, I thought you had your mic. Oh, Representative Clark.
So, Madam Chairman, Mr. Chairman, do we know approximately what the value of the tax credit is that would be invested per business? Is there an estimate? And then I see there's the $500,000 construction, but what about the cost of the tax credit? What is that value?
Cost of what?
What is the value of the tax credit that the business would be getting?
The sales tax credit. So the value of what they buy for equipment and so forth to put into that industry to start it, the sales tax exemption for that. Mm-hmm. And that goes for a period of time, like I said, what the local government says, and the property tax exemption for that period of time on the facility that they're in.
Representative Clark.
So there's no ballpark idea of what that investment is?
Each one will be different, Representative Clark.
Because I was trying to again figure out what the cost per job is.
Fiscal note, hopefully we'll have that by the time we come back next week.
Okay.
We've been working on that, and Representative Soderbergh gave us a preliminary one. I think when you consider things like how many new school kids are going to go into our schools at about $9,000-$10,000 per kid, how many people are going to buy houses that will start paying property taxes, how many people are going to use services and goods from the city and county, I think along with the taxes and spinoff jobs, I think you're going to look at what I think will be a positive thing to begin with. And the first time that the state gives them, starts paying the debt off that is incurred, I believe it's 2 years ahead of time. Is that correct? Madam Chairman, can Ms. Newman answer?
Yes, Ms. Newman.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the taxes are set up as tax refunds, mm-hmm. so they would be there would be a lag, and at least initially there's a 2-year lag, because the way the bill is currently drafted, they have 2 years to meet the goals, and then they could start applying for the refunds of the taxes designated in the bill.
Thank you. What I was trying to understand, Mr. Chairman, is as I said, how much are we going to be spending per job? And it sounds like it's going to be pretty hard to figure it out, except for the construction. If we just did the construction, it'd be $50,000 per job. But if it's all these other tax credits, which the schools and the county and the city all have to agree to, it does sound like it would be very individualized. I mean, it would be very difficult to estimate it, or have we got a track record from Job Z to use as a measuring?
Actually, with Job Z, they had a business calculator that they could tell ahead of time what the benefits of the industry were. Now, the cost of the state and the benefit of the industry are two different things, but I'm sure Deed will have a better answer. Right. And I really believe that this is a program that will give a cost benefit. And the number one thing that I think all of us said when we were knocking on doors and going to candidate forums or whatever else we all do is the number one thing we heard from people is we want jobs. So far as being a chairman or lead Republican on the Economic Development Committee, in 2003 they took 35% of our budget away, 2004 they took 35% of our budget away. Last session, they took 17% of our budget away. It's very apparent that people are talking without believing in what they're saying. So Representative Mahoney and I both agree 100% on what our neighboring states are doing to us. I think it's time that we fight back, and I think this is the one thing that we're going to have a chance to do that will put a little bit of dent in what they want to do to us. I used to put up with the South Sioux Falls commercials, come to Minnesota, save $1 million. Now I'm putting up with the Iowans, too. Would you please help me out?
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, I just want to say I know your intentions are great, and I really appreciate some of the changes you've made in this as compared to Job Z. I just still want to know what it's going to cost.
Thank you. If you don't mind, Representative Mullery, we'll wait till next meeting to continue.
Madam Chair, it's just a point.
Okay.
It's brief. Like less than a minute. I just wanted to say, Representative Gunther, you said that no other state excluded areas. I think if you look back to the original, I can't remember if it was Michigan or Pennsylvania, was one of the first to start this, and they actually excluded the whole state except for inner city urban areas that were poor.
That could be, they eventually included them all.
Thank you. Well, with that, we will lay this over till the next meeting, and the meeting is adjourned.